Hi there, thanks so much for listening. Beginning of a new week here on the Nick Luck Daily Podcast and the run-up to the 150th Kentucky Derby. A truly historic run for the Roses, and you'll be hearing a bit more about it during the episodes over the course of the week. But if you want to follow your American racing, do your research, and you don't live in the United States, then the best place to do it is on the Racing app. Download the Racing app now, and free of charge, you can get all the past performances and one-click video form for all the runners in the Kentucky Derby and every American horse race. And you don't need to have a betting account. You just need to get on the Racing app and get cracking.
You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis. By the Racehorse Owners Association. And by the Racing App, in partnership with FitzDares.
Good morning, welcome to the show. It is Monday, April the 29th. I'm coming to you this morning from Zurich Airport, just landed from Hong Kong, and I've got about 2 hours before leaving for Washington, where I'll be then moving on to Louisville ahead of the Kentucky Derby this weekend. So this is a perfect layover in which to bring you Monday's podcast. Monday's podcast, which I'm afraid, given how much we've had to celebrate over the last weekend all across the globe, and particularly with a rousing finale to the UK jump season, Willie Mullins and John Bonnet and the rest, I'm afraid we have to start with very sad news that will have reached most of you by now, that John Bond's stablemate, Shishkin, one of the more celebrated horses in UK jump racing, very sadly died in an accident in his stable at home, Nicky Henderson Seven Barrows Base, last night. And that news was released almost immediately with a statement from Nicky Henderson. Lee Moff said, senior writer from the Racing Post, is with me now. That's a desperate way to begin the week, Lee, because Shishkin was a much talked about horse, not always straightforward, but always very talented.
Yes, Nick, it was desperate news either to go to bed to last night or to wake up to this morning, because as you say, Shishkin really was one of the sport's most popular performers. He had absolutely earned that popularity. And I think if you looked at the outpouring of sadness and affection and sympathy that flew through the often hostile environment that is Twitter or X last night and this morning, you will understand the extent to which Shishkin had forged a place in the heart of racing fans. He was a fabulous horse. He was a horse with character, with quirks, but also with an abundance of courage, as anyone who, first of all, I'd say, saw the Supreme Novices Hurdle success in 2020, but more significantly, that Clarence House Chase showdown with an Ergamene in 2022, when he really looked beaten, he really should have been beaten, but he emerged victorious. That was one of the great days of jump racing at Ascot. It was a great day for Shishkin. It's desperately sad that he's no longer with us, and the heart goes out to all those associated with him at Seven Barrows and to his owners, the Donnellys.
And that just a couple of days after Nicky Henderson had really rounded off what had been an up and down campaign with a fair bit of style. John Bonn with brio in the celebration chase at Sandown, beating old rival El Fabiello, Edward Stone, running a great race. I thought this was one of the performances of the season, Lee.
I agree. I think he was magnificent, Nick, on Saturday. And in some ways, it reinforced an impression I had got over the weeks going into, or the weeks after Cheltenham, really, when obviously we weren't able to see John Bonn in the champion chase. But all through the winter, Nicky Henderson had made it very clear that he was keen on the rematch with El Fabiello in the Cheltenham, in the champion chase. And you got the impression that Nicky thought revenge could be had in the champion chase. Now, that obviously didn't happen at Cheltenham. El Fabiolo fluffed his lines. John Bonn didn't even get there. But I remember speaking to Nikki's great friend, the bloodstock agent David Minton at Aintree. And we were talking about Nikki's woe at Cheltenham and how things had turned out there. And it was the day when Sugino and Shishkin had both run at Aintree. David Sugino had won at Aintree, and the following day John won one. And Minty talked about those two horses as the two bankers that Nicky had felt he had going into the Cheltenham Festival, his two big chances. So he really did think John Bond was going to beat El Fabiolo. He beat him on Saturday. There were a couple of jumping errors. He wasn't great at the pond fence, but El Fabiolo's jumping was worse than John Bond's. At times, John Bond jumped superbly. And I think he won that race because he was the best horse in the race. And I believe that if John Bond and El Fabiolo met again over 2 miles and both were able to deliver, I think John Bond would probably win that race. I think he is exceptionally good at his best. Remember, he was winning that race on Saturday, Nick, only a couple of weeks after a very hard task and a hard tussle in the Melling Chase at Aintree. It was a big win for him. And again, when we talk about Shishkin and the affection with which he was held in Seven Barrows, that applies to John Bond. Nicky made the point that whenever JP McManus rings Nicky Henderson, his first question is always, how is John Bond? You know, these horses, they become like friends, not just to their connections, but to fans as well. And I think John Bond is one of those too.
Elsewhere on Saturday, it was all about Willie Mullins and the completely unsurprising success in the British Trainers Championship. If you've been following this podcast or this sport for the last 2 or 3 weeks, once he declared his hand, once he won the Grand National and it was all systems go and action stations at Clissutton to get all the horses where they needed to be, there was a sense of complete inevitability about it. But the fact that he should land the Grand National, the Scottish Grand National and the Better 365 Gold Cup, the last two with pretty unheralded horses, both ridden by Danny Mullins, just speaks volumes for the depth. What struck me watching from afar, Lee, and you were there, and I'd like to know your perspective on this, was suddenly all that chat about how British racing needs to have some moment of introspection and how this is a disaster for our trainers and so forth had been washed away by a tide of appreciation that we might be living through something very unusual and that there's no point trying to fight that. Rather, you might just celebrate it and imagine what might happen next year.
Yeah, Nick, you sensed from afar there what was absolutely the case. I made that point in my post piece from Sandon on Saturday and on what became Steedman on Sunday yesterday. there was tremendous warmth and goodwill towards Willie Mullins. There wasn't an atmosphere at Sandown on Saturday of soul searching, of introspection. People weren't asking, with a British jump racing, where do we go from here? The sport clearly all season and for longer than that in this country, in Britain, has had questions of how do we compete with the domination of Ireland and more particularly the domination of Willie Mullins. But it wasn't like that on Saturday. Willie had made the point when we spoke at Aintree of how he had been going around Aintree before that Cheltenham and elsewhere. And people in Britain had been congratulating him for his successes, but wishing him well in the championship challenge. And you got that sense on Saturday. There'd been a victory tour across the country during the week with Patrick Mullins going here, there and everywhere, riding winners, Willie Mullins sending horses here, there and everywhere. And on Saturday, I think the largely a British audience at Sandown really wanted to congratulate him, to say well done, to say thank you for supporting the sport here, which he has done by going for this Trainers Championship, and to salute a remarkable achievement that has been accomplished by someone who is incredibly popular across the sport. Yeah. And that warmth was really there all around the winner's enclosure after the Bet 365 Gold Cup and when Willie got his Trainers Championship trophy. And he picked up on it. You know, he was very aware that this felt like a celebration, and people were genuinely pleased for him because I think people could see what he'd achieved 70 years on from Vincent O'Brien becoming the first Irish trainer to win the British Jumps title from Ireland. That was an achievement that wasn't lost on Willie, nor was it lost on the Jumps fans who were at Sandown. It was a great day, great atmosphere, and Willie made clear that just as Vincent O'Brien had completed back-to-back title victories, that so too that would be his aim. But I think he acknowledges that this season's title wouldn't have been won had he not won the Grand National. You can't always bank on winning the Grand National. So in all probability, Nick, I think we're going to see quite a lot more of the Clissutton superstars through that core winter period and on those big Saturdays through November, December, January and February. And if that is the case, it will be a great thing.
It would be a great thing. And I'll tell you why it would also be a great thing, Lee. And that is because I think some of people's frustration, sort of once a week rating viewers' frustration with the Cheltenham Festival is something to do with a dissociation between what they're watching those 4 days and what they've been watching for the rest of the season on ITV or whatever. The more Mullins, the more Elliot you actually get during the season here in, or sorry, here, I'm not anywhere near you at the moment, UK, then the more relation that has to what they're seeing at their championship meeting. And I think that's got to be a good thing. Do you not agree?
I do. I think that's absolutely right. I think there's almost a parallel with the Melbourne Cup when it was being dominated by internationals and half the field was made up of European horses. Now, the locals there, they weren't best pleased that their great race was being taken out of the country regularly. But I think they also felt it meant that the previous months of racing that they'd been watching were almost irrelevant. And I think that is the case again with the Irish domination at the Cheltenham Festival. For British racing fans, it means that you sit down watching action from Newbury, Ascot, Cheltenham or Sandown on a Saturday and you half wonder, well, this seems great now and it seems important now, but does it actually have any bearing on what we'll see when we get to the grand finals that are the Cheltenham Festival? And if we do see more of these Clissutton stars, and it's perfectly possible that Willie has so many in each of the big divisions that he can, in all likelihood, separate them so that he doesn't threaten his monopoly and hegemony in Ireland, but while at the same time giving himself a very realistic shot at the British title as well. And in some ways, I think everyone benefits from that, apart from perhaps from those trainers who are looking to win the big races in Britain on Saturday. But in a wider sense, we've made the point before that success breeds success and good horses are improved by racing against good horses. So perhaps if those big races through Britain in the winter are made more competitive by the top Willie Mullins animals coming over, then maybe we'll all benefit.
Well, it was unsurprising that Willie Mullins had a lot of people to thank on Saturday, this momentous achievement, smiles all round, but one man's name kept coming to the fore, and that was David Casey, who's been such a key ally down the years in really building Clissutton from being a powerful stable to a superpower. David's with me now to reflect on what I'm sure has been an amazing weekend, and then, of course, Punchestown to come. How was that feeling Saturday night? How did you reflect on these last 3 or 4 weeks? Say, Cheltenham to here, I guess.
There wasn't much reflection because there was yesterday morning was punches on deck, so you're always thinking forward. You know, the time waits for nobody, so obviously while it was great to do it, and we celebrated a little bit at the races on Saturday, I was still in bed early Saturday night and I was up riding out yesterday morning and doing the decks for Punchestown, so I'm sure maybe when Punchestown's all over next week we'll sit down and have a think about it, but it was great to do it, obviously, you know, and it was great that it just worked out the way it did.
I think your best place, maybe Jackie's best place, but maybe aside from Jackie, your best place to tell us how Willie Mullins has gone from A to B. I mean, when did you start with him?
I started in 1994. That's a long time ago.
I mean,
now
that's quite something.
And I was an amateur rider for a month, and then I went conditional, and and from there on, you know, so we've been in another place obviously for 30 years now, so but from where it started to where it is now, you know, it's just his attention to detail and always trying to improve every year, you know, never stop improving or looking for an edge or looking for somewhere that it can make the place better, the facilities better, the horses better, the staff better, you know, so I think that's it, like, that always striving to be better, you know, to make the place better.
I mean, when you first met him, did you think, yeah, this guy's a bit different, he just does things differently to other people? Because obviously the numbers in those days wouldn't necessarily have told us that.
No, like, when I arrived, we had 30 horses, and Willie and Jackie were still riding out. There was three of us working in the yard, and Willie and Jackie were riding out as well, you know, so it was all hands on deck. It wasn't like it is now, and, you know, but you could see the effort that he was putting in, and obviously I wasn't there that long. It was only 6 or 7 months later, I think, when Tourist Attraction won at Cheltenham, and that was absolutely ginormous at the time for the yard, you know, so, and but it just built it up from there. But you see, from everything that he put in, and just listening to him, and I didn't sort of nearly ask many questions, but just listening to what he said and taking all of that on board, you know, you just got the idea that this man thinks a little bit different.
And so many people in this sport, these jobs are so transient. People are very restless. Oh, I want to go and do something else. I want to do this. Where's the next opportunity? What stopped you doing that, do you think?
I could just probably see where it was going, and I enjoyed the atmosphere, and I enjoyed listening to Willie and watching what he was doing, and you know, I mean, obviously it's not all roses, obviously there's ups and downs in every game, but I enjoyed the whole experience, and you know, I thought, where better to be? Like, if you're going to be somewhere, you might as well be with the best.
And I guess not everyone appreciates that kind of relentless energy. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a way of stopping him in any respect. You know, there's a guy who wakes up in the morning and is going, and then goes to bed at some point and, you know, doesn't really stop.
Yeah, it's pretty much non-stop. But I mean, Willie is a very, very relaxed character around the yard, you know, that kind of way. So, and I think that pays off. You see it in the horses, when people come to the yard and have a look around, and they say, oh, horses on the gallop are very relaxed, and the staff are relaxed. And, you know, I think it all builds into a good performance, you know, where there's not a lot of stress and tension going around the yard. And I think that suits as well. You know, obviously, there are moments when it is obviously a little bit different, but you need that too. But I think all of that just helps the yard progress, you know.
From a personal perspective, and it can be something beyond the obvious if you want it to be, is there a single race or performance this season that has given you a particular kick or a particular level of satisfaction?
Not so much that. I suppose just obviously when horses win at the big festivals, it's great. Obviously the Dublin Racing Festival and Cheltenham and Aintree, and obviously now on to Punchestown and Fairy House. All of those races, I think the horse that probably stood out for me was Ballyburn. We expected him to go and win at Cheltenham, but I thought he just did way more than what we thought he would do. And obviously then for Galloping as well, to go and win his second Gold Cup, you know, I thought that was really special.
And what are you expecting from the Punchestown Gold Cup this week? Are you expecting something rather different from what happened last year when Galloping was defeated?
Well, you're hoping for something different anyway.
You've got the close-up this year relative to last year.
Yeah. Listen, the horse, he seems in great order. He seems really well in himself. He's been working really well. So you're very hopeful. Obviously, fast or slow, didn't really have a hard race in Cheltenham. He's probably coming into it a little bit fresher. So he'd be tough to beat, obviously, after winning the race last year and winning around Punchestown in the John Durkin. So it'll be tough, but We think Galloping is in a very good place at the moment, so obviously we're very hopeful, you know.
David, thanks for your time this morning.
No, but at any time, Nick.
Well, so many people keen to pay tribute to Willie Mullins, quite rightly, and I loved it that Tom Magner, grandson of Dr. Vincent O'Brien, took the time to post a message on X saying how much, as he put it, Pops would have loved this and really recognised that achievement of winning trainers' titles in both Britain and Ireland. Tom, you were watching on with great admiration.
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic for Willie and all his team, but it was huge for Irish racing. And you know, you see how much it meant to Willie and all his team. And God, he's been the most phenomenal trainer, as Ireland has so many good national hunt trainers as well. But I know that Pops was obviously very passionate about the national hunt game in his early years. He won 3 Grand Nationals, Gold Cups. He followed it very closely, and I know he was very proud of that trainer's title in the UK. And I think it was great for Willie to repeat it, because it hasn't been done for a long time, but it's been well due, and so many good trainers in Ireland, you know, they're getting closer and closer.
And you mentioned the national hunt heritage of Coolmore as well. It's sometimes worth remembering that you're down in Australia supervising, you know, some wonderful stallions. We've talked about Justify on this podcast a million times. We're going to talk about two tremendously exciting horses in a minute, but the jumping's at the heart of it, really. It's the lifeblood of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose our family have been in this game since the 1850s, down in Cork in Ireland. And, you know, the backbone of Coolmore, the foundation of the whole thing, started with National Hunt. And, yeah, we're very close to it indeed.
Let's talk this weekend. Okay, so you're in Australia now. Where's the plane going? Are you coming to Newmarket for City of Troy, or are you coming to Churchill Downs for Sierra Leone?
I said to the kids after dinner tonight, we'd flick a coin and see where to go, because you don't get chances like this very often. Obviously, you know, for Derek and Michael Tabor and Dad and everybody to have a chance with Sierra Leone is just beyond exciting. Dad hasn't won the Kentucky Derby, and to do it, you know, in the navy blue colours would be pretty special. Mm. You know, it's the 150th running of the Kentucky Derby, so you know, you can feel the build up that it's like in Kentucky down here in Australia. But then on the other side you have City of Troy, and we know what Aidan taught him as a 2-year-old. We know how the whole winter's been going. We've been, you know, watching his work with great excitement. So it's, you know, it's a tough one, but it's a great position to be in.
What do the kids want to do?
They want to come with me, but they've got school. But I'd say, listen, it's exciting to have, you know, these good horses in races. But listen, we're in the game a long time, and you know, most times it doesn't happen. So just by the off chance it does happen in either place, it'd just be special to be there.
So those navy silks are going to be examined rigorously and with importance this weekend, Lee.
They are, Nick. I'm pretty sure in the past, and you'll know this better than I would do, that Michael Tabor has sometimes headed off to Kentucky in favour of Newmarket for this weekend, when the two great races tend to clash. Maybe he'll do so again, but I think there is such a hullabaloo and sense of something potentially momentous happening with City of Troy, not just on Saturday but through this year, that I expect all the Coolmore grandees to be at Newmarket on Saturday. I think the extent to which City of Troy has developed this standing and this aura is underlined by the fact he's 4-6, 4-7 in the betting, Nick, for what to me actually looks like it could be a pretty deep 2,000 guineas. Rosalian was excellent in the Jean-Luc Lagardère on his final start. His Ascot win from earlier in the season couldn't have worked out better. You have horses like Notable Speech, who has looked thrilling.
Yeah, just on Rosalian, I noticed that our pod colleague David Yates, I was very impressed with this. Mm. Having recovered from his stag night on Saturday, for which I think there was an enormous guest list, he managed to get an exclusive on Sunday, which was that Rosalian wouldn't run in the guineas if the ground was soft.
Well, that's an interesting one, isn't it? I think, to be fair, Richard Hannon, they have made clear that he wouldn't want that sort of ground, but it's still a bold call and a good one from Yatesy to get that he wouldn't run if the ground is soft. We had a heck of a lot of rain around these parts, certainly over the weekend, that Newmarket, you would hope, wouldn't be getting that sort of ground. We tend not to get soft ground guineas, do we? But you never know. But I think it's a deep guineas, Nick. I think there's lots of fascination in there. Clive Cox seems bullish about Ghost Rider. Knight Raider has looked potentially top notch, even though he's only raced at Southwell so far. And yet, you listen to anyone from the Coolmore or Ballydore camps talking, and you do get the impression that they believe City of Troy is a bit different. And I know we can be a bit cynical and say, well, the marketing around these Ballydore Coolmore horses tends to be ramped up to extreme levels when they think they've got a good one. But I think they genuinely do believe that. It was good to see Nick Ballydore putting out some social media content of City of Troy's gallop the other day. I think that's welcome. I mean, maybe that's an indication that they appreciate the interest in this horse. I think it's going to be a thrilling day at Newmarket on Saturday. And I hope we do see something special.
All right, well, clearly we know, because we've discussed it so much on this podcast, that horses like City of Troy and Rosalian are going to take so many column inches. But you know, Clive Cox in recent days has been saying that Ghost Rider needs some serious attention. Owner Jeff Smith also has See the Fire in the 1,000 guineas. And Littleton Studs' David Bowe joins me now. David, it could be a pretty big weekend, flying slightly under the radar at the moment.
Well, it seems that way. I was surprised that Ghost Rider and See the Fire, for that matter, were slightly overlooked in the media, but that's no harm. It puts an awful lot less pressure on us. But both Clive and Andrew are extremely happy with both of the horses. Ghost Rider has been training very well. Clive is he's very impressed with him. And looking at the horse physically, he looks like he's grown into that big frame of his, and he's much more of an athlete. I mean, he doesn't have to improve a huge amount to make a good account of himself, given he's a winner over course and distance. Rather exciting. And See the Fire, I mean, she ran a blinder, I thought, in the Filly's Mile. And she'll certainly see it out, and both Andrew and Oisin are over the moon with her work at home.
Yeah.
So I think you know, without being over the top, I think we're in pretty good shape in both camps.
I mean, in 8 out of 10, 2,000 guineas, you'd say, oh, Ghost Rider, very interesting. Obviously, you could be up against freakish talents here. Still, you've got to be in it. I mean, the 1,000 guineas is much more open, isn't it? And the way that See the Fire went through the May Hill before the Filly's Mile, I thought she just looked really, really good, but just short of street wisdom.
I think that's it exactly, Nick. She wasn't streetwise. She's a little bit green. She hung a little bit, all down to greenness. She doesn't do that at home, and I think she's grown up an awful lot, and she seems to be just much more in command of herself as an individual. And as I said, Andrew and Oisin are very happy with her, and you know, you just get that kind of feeling speaking to the trainers that they have a quiet confidence in both of our two. It is open, much more open than the 1,000, but equally both races are going to be tough. And we are facing some stiff opposition. The City of Troy is a serious machine. But we've done it over course and distance, which is quite encouraging. And look, it's a massive weekend for us. But both horses, I believe, are being delivered as good as they possibly can be. So it'll be in the lap of the gods. But we're going there quietly confident, to be fair.
So what a time of year for the sport globally. Kentucky Derby, 2,000 guineas to come. We've just had the Jumps finale. And of course, as you'll know, I've been in Hong Kong for their Big Champions Day over the weekend. And yesterday provided us with an awful lot of drama, much of it added to by the rain, the heavy rain that had fallen through the week. That blunted the speed, the turn of foot of Golden 60 in the Champions Mile. He wasn't able to make it an 11th Group 1 success. He got roared into the paddock by the crowd, roared down to the start, roared home, but he could only finish a rather flat fourth behind the brilliantly ridden Beauty Eternal. Zach Purton setting steady fractions on the front and producing a riding masterclass. It was three Australasian riding masterclasses as well, because the sprint went to Invincible Sage, a horse who I think has got plenty of upside moving forward, and was ridden by Hugh Bowman. And then James McDonald was remarkable again on Romantic Warrior, a horse with such courage, such bravery. Nothing went right for him through the race. A horrible trip. And still he managed to win and defeat Prognosis. Now, the news is that the Japanese star Prognosis, who was second, missed the break. Big wild mid-race move from Yuga Kawada. He may well come to Royal Ascot. That would be quite something. As for the winner, Romantic Warrior, what next for him? It had been mooted that Japan might be on the agenda. I first of all began by asking his trainer, Danny Shum, just how proud he was of yesterday's effort, given how many times he's been to the well in his career.
Oh, I feel the first half race, I feel the race should be loose. Because all his situation is the worst situation. So you can see the first race to the seventh race, the horse can run good in that position.
Yeah, they were all winning from the front, weren't they? And he was quite a long way back.
Long way back. Also, you know, the Philip look cover. Oh, come on, Jesus Christ. I think the race should be gone. But until I saw the 800 meters, I saw a gem put him on the two dips. He's very smart. He got talent. He's a classic jockey. Because he won't struggle. He said, attack position. I wait a little bit. Put him on the 6-7 two deep. And then, in the right time, he passed the button and then go. So, the horse used a lot of energy, to be honest. Even though he haven't tell me when he come to the photo, winning photo area. He never told me the horse feel tired. This time, he told me, the horse feel tired. Quick. Tell the quick, I don't want to sit on him. I want him to relax a little bit more. You know what I mean, huh? So, he's a bit tired, to be honest. He broke, even take the beating book.
He was having a good blow today.
So I need to see. I really power of him. He tried all his best. But I need to look after him. I have to keep him happy. I have to keep him healthy. So I need to see the next few days. How he pull up, how he eat, how he walk. Even how he sits, I have to check it very carefully.
Yeah. He's laid it all out there on the line today, and there was that bizarre, extraordinary moment halfway down the back where Yuga Kawada set Prognosis alight, made this wild move and almost came up sides, James. But to your horse's great credit, he didn't grab hold or race keenly or anything like that.
No, he's a relaxed horse. But even in a really worst situation, the horse waiting for James McDonald's instructions. What do you want me to do? He likes to talk. He look like he can talk to James, you know. What do you want me to do? Okay, you want to put me there, and then you want me to fight? I fight for you. He fight for the last 200 meters. Wow, it's amazing. Yeah, great run.
It was such a hard race for you to watch for so much of the race.
Yeah.
But then when you get down to the final 200 meters, and effectively it's you and Prognosis, could be you and any other horse, there must be a bit of you that thinks, nah, they don't get past me. I win when I'm in these situations.
Usually I would think this. But this time I think, even my boss, but I still worry about Prognosis can pass me at the last 50 or 80 meters. So I just keep a bit quiet.
you talk about the boss, the owner, Peter Lau. He's a wonderful sportsman. And you and he went on that great journey to Australia and won the Cox Plate. And everybody around the world wants to see this horse in their own country. You were talking about the Yasuda Kinen, one of Japan's biggest races before today. Has that race made you think differently?
Yes, I have to check it out the next few days because I don't want to put a little bit, even 10%, it's not really 100%, even 90%. I won't like to take him to any outside this country unless I feel he's 100%. I don't want to put a horse... not really 100% fit. Why? I really like to take the horse happy, sound, and he will be competitive. Then I like to take them outside. I like to take them challenge everywhere in the world. But if he's not there, the plan has to be a little bit changed.
Well, he is the very definition of a lion-hearted racehorse. He's given us a lot of pleasure today. Danny, thanks so much. Well
thank
done.
You. Thank thanks. You very much. Thanks. Thank you.
Sometimes you have to leave the UK and look on from afar and then kind of cover one eye and look at social media to realize just how much bitching and moaning there is in UK horse racing. I mean, this hullabaloo surrounding a big billboard advert for Royal Ascot, for those people who haven't seen it, Lee, just quickly as you can, describe what you see. You look at this advert, what does it say? What do you see?
I think it looks like a scene around a garden allotments. There are two people dressed to the finery, seemingly enjoying a day at Royal Ascot, and there is a lady in the far right hand corner of the picture looking on at them, and there are no horses in the picture, and that appears to have upset a lot of people, because it people want to see adverts with with horses in them, and they don't see that here. But it is very in keeping with the marketing campaign that Ascot, I think, carried for the first time last year for the Royal Meeting. It's the Ascot U catchline, tagline. And this is in one of those. And to be fair, I think last year's campaign received an awful lot of positive coverage.
Yeah, so this one is, there's you. So you is the lady in her casual gardening clothes looking on with envy at the couple, then all dolled up to the nines, and then there's the Ascot in you. I have absolutely no problem with it at all. In fact, I think it's quite clever. I'm going to duck, and I'm out of the country for a week, so I can wait till I get back for the flat. But
yeah,
conceptually it's absolutely fine. It's at least it makes you look and think and go, oh, what's that? And yeah, that's what you want from an advert, especially billboard advert. What is that? Oh,
that's
let me have a look. You know,
that's right.
Immediately identifiable as what Royal Ascot means to an awful lot of people. You know, I think the complaining about that is way off the mark.
And I think that there have been complaints regarding the fact that there are sort of a couple of people of colour looking on sort of from seated, one guy from on the ground looking up at the two people at Royal Ascot. There's the lady with a wheelbarrow on the far left-hand side of the picture, looking at the two Ascot racegoers, one of whom is also a person of colour as well. And I'm not from a marketing background, Nick, but I know the general campaign, if we talk about the general campaign, the Ascot U thing, it is one that people have noticed. And if there is an event where racing people might have to acknowledge that horses aren't necessarily pivotal to everyone's enjoyment of the event, it is Royal Ascot, because realistically there are those who go for the racing and there are those who have no interest whatsoever in the racing and enjoy it for something completely different.
Well, put it this way, I significantly prefer it to the Derby advert, which is just two random guys punching the air saying Epsom's calling, because I'm not sure if you looked at that, you'd really have any clue what that meant. But I feel bad saying that as well, Lee, because after your lengthy pieces in the Racing Post over the weekend examining the current state and health of the Jockey Club, I don't feel like giving the Jockey Club a kicking when they're down and adding fuel to the fire. But, you know, I just think these adverts, yes, they have to be eye-catching, but they have to, you know, engage people's mind and engage with their creative juices, and I'm not sure that one does.
No, it's rubbish. It's really it looks, the Ascot one looks like it cost a fortune. The Derby one doesn't, which is a shame. But it's not the first advert that we've seen for a Jockey Club event that does look a bit cheap and naff. That said, I wouldn't be any good at creating advertising, so I'm not necessarily sure I'm the right person to be critiquing it. But it's not impressive in a wider sense, though, Nick, as you say, doesn't feel right to be giving them a kicking right now, because this is a difficult time for the Jockey Club. I wrote a big read for the Racing Post in Sunday's edition, followed up with a column today, trying to reveal what is going on inside the Jockey Club at the moment. They are tough times. The Jockey Club is a private members club, just under 200 members. and the membership are very unhappy at the moment, or a number of the members, high profile senior members, are unhappy. There are complaints regarding the finances of the Jockey Club, particularly linked to what they see as messes surrounding the Cheltenham Festival, where attendances fell for the last 2 years. And there's a belief that the executive should have seen that coming at an earlier stage. But more widely, the complaint is regarding what they perceive to be an excessive move towards centralised control at the expense of local Jockey Club racecourses, local Jockey Club members, those on racecourse committees, a feeling that too many jobs have gone to the centre to people who don't really know a lot about horse racing, and a view that the Jockey Club is being structured increasingly in a way that makes it feel more akin to a Google or an Amazon than the racecourse business, like Britain's largest commercial racing organisation, that it is.
It's interesting. I speak with some inside knowledge, as far as I'm on a racecourse committee. I'm not a member of the Jockey Club, but on a racecourse committee, and there is definitely been a move since the interview I did with Matt Powell on this podcast during Cheltenham, and since a few conversations that people have had subsequently to try and bolster and really outline a proper strategy for local sponsorship. And of course that all ties in with racecourses' relationships with communities, which are so incredibly important to their continuing success. It's all very well for big national marketing campaigns to be run from the centre, but obviously you want to make sure that you are a key space and hub in your local area, not just for horse racing. Sometimes you have huge acreages in the middle of quite densely populated spaces, and I think the sport has a responsibility to those communities to be a really significant part of them. So it's really good to see that local strategy coming through, but it's a question of whether it assuages the concerns of the membership. One point out of your article, and it's not going to interest that many people, Lee, I don't really understand why the membership can't be published. I mean, if you accept the offer of being a member of the Jockey Club, why wouldn't you want it known? I mean, why would you want to hide it?
Absolutely. And that's a point I've gone in again with my column today, Nick. I think clearly the members have questions of the executive, but they should also have questions of themselves. Nevin Truesdale, I had a 90-minute conversation with him the other day. He made clear that it is the executive's wish, preference, for the membership to be published. It always used to be once a year when the Jockey Club elects new members. We used to get that, used to come with a full list of the Jockey Club's membership. You used to be able to see it digitally if you wanted to. And it's important, Nick, because the Jockey Club is an organisation that is governed by Royal Charter. It's a different sort of organisation. It is there for the good of British racing. Its members have enormous powers. While they're unhappy now about centralised control, they have the power to, from within their own group, to elect a board of stewards that is the ultimate decision-making authority for the Jockey Club, that appoints a chief executive, that therefore is incredibly powerful. And I think to not have the membership listed is simply inadequate. It strengthens concerns re transparency and perception, which are, from my perspective, do exist. I spoke to our pod colleague Rishi Prasad, who was elected a Jockey Club member late last year, and he is adamant that there are moves to change that the Jockey Club members understand how they might be perceived and they want to change. And I've no reason to think that Rishi is in any way wrong about that, but there are perception issues regarding the Jockey Club. It is seen by many people as an organisation that represents a small percentage of the racing community. The perception is that it's quite a conservative organisation. Now, the racing's elite tends to be quite conservative, but we've got a situation.
Well, I mean,
now,
we need to draw a distinction here, don't we, Lee? I mean, for centuries, the Jockey Club would have been considered a conservative organisation with a small c. And of course, a lot of people would argue that's not a bad thing, because yeah, it is trying to, you know, preserve, conserve everything.
Yeah. Long-term approach. Heritage. Yeah.
the long-term approach, prudent financially.
Yeah, completely agree. Yeah.
The small C. But of course, in recent years, you could say, right, conservative with a big C, because there are a lot of people involved that are actively connected to the Conservative Party.
Yes. Whereas
in the old days of all the, you might call them the more traditional toffs.
Yeah.
They probably weren't. I'm sure most of them voted Tory, but they weren't kind of obviously affiliated to the Conservative Party. So I don't know whether that's, I think it's probably happenstance, really. But what you don't want is an organization that's seen, as your point makes out, at massive right angles to the way that kind of.
Well, that's right.
It needs to be apolitical anyway, really, doesn't it?
It does, Nick. Yeah. And I pointed out in the piece that you have a situation now where you have Sandy Dudgeon, who is a former Conservative Party donor, will be replaced as senior steward by Baroness Harding, a Conservative Party peer who's married to a Conservative Party MP, John Penrose, just as, in all probability, Sir Keir Starmer is elected to power with a huge majority as a Labour Prime Minister. The optics of the Jockey Club's conservatism, with a big C in that sense, I don't think are helpful. But I suspect that that is an optic that hadn't really occurred to most people within the organisation. And I think sometimes it requires others to point out how things might look and how things might need to change for that change to be accelerated. Rishi was clear that the Jockey Club is aware of its perception, how it's perceived, and they want to change. And I'm sure he's right. And hopefully that will accelerate over the coming years.
One Rishi is a likely future leader than the other, I suspect. I'll leave you to guess which.
See what you did there.
Well, in amongst all that's happened over the weekend, you probably weren't paying that much attention to which stallions were doing well where, but it certainly occurred to me when I saw Top Gun winning 100 grand handicap in Hong Kong, fresh off the back of Okeechobee and the Judmont Silks winning at Sandown on Friday, that Time Test, who was hot a couple of years ago and has been as cold as the freezer section in Iceland recently, might just be about to warm up again. Is it too little too late? I don't know. He stands at the national stud. Anna Kerr is the chief executive. I think I put it in stark but realistic terms there, Anna. But it seems a good chance to remind people about him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the years when he had that real wave were in 2021 and 2022, when he covered such big books, and those first crops are coming through now. So Betty Clover was a smart two-year-old winner for Eve Jobbenhausen a couple of weeks ago. It's nice to see him getting that good early two-year-old, and that would be from the 2022 crop. He's covered respectable books last year and again this year, so the numbers are still there coming through, and we've supported him with some very nice mares of our own, including Mystical Air, who's a half sister to Group 3 winner Carolina Reaper, and she's an absolutely cracking Time Test colt on the ground. So I think that's our responsibility is to try and keep quality mares going into them to keep the momentum going forward. As you say, stallion proper is such a volatile market, isn't it? You've got to, once they hit the track, there's a lot of hoping that goes on.
And would it be fair to say that in any other stud, if he'd gone through a cold spell and the interest wasn't there, he'd be on the transfer list? But at the national stud, particularly given the way that the shareholding is, you are in a position to be able to stick by stallions that little bit longer, so you can see them through bumps in the road.
Yeah, and I think it's something that is becoming increasingly important. I mean, you look in recent months, I was quite struck. A few weeks ago, Twilight Sun had a particularly fantastic weekend where he had about three or four winners in decent races. And these older horses, it's important that we have that depth in the stallion market, so there are other options for people, as well as keeping the new stock coming through. And this has been a really good year for first season sires in the UK with what's retired this year. And it's really important that we have that depth to if our broodmare band is currently is contracting, we need to have the stallions to support it and to encourage people to keep mares in this country.
All right, Lee is still with me and has a tip for you for today.
Evening racing at Windsor on a Monday, Nick. Summer is definitely galloping towards us, and I hope galloping past the post in front will be fast steps in the 6:39 at Windsor, the Gilby's Bar Restaurant and Tanhouse Eton Handicap. A horse who's got great course form at Windsor. The trainer, Rod Millman, has been firing in winners of late. Horses running really well, and I'm hoping that Fast Steps can continue his love affair with the Riverside venue in the 6:39 at Windsor tonight. Fast Steps.
Lee, thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening. That was Monday, the 29th of April. I will be back with you tomorrow, hopefully, United Airlines permitting, from Louisville, Kentucky, in the build-up to the 150th run for the Roses. We'll see you then. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App in partnership with FitzDares.